listening to Groundwire, community news from coast to coast to coast. Welcome to the December 21st edition of Groundwire, brought to you by the National Campus and Community Radio Association. A different campus community station produces each episode of Groundwire. This time it was CKUT Radio in Montreal. I'm Courtney Kirkby, and this is David Koch.
Today on Groundwire, sex workers and their allies marched through downtown Montreal to demand an end to violence against sex workers. The movement against the occupation of Gaza continues 1 year after the Israeli army's attack on the Gaza Strip. The Canadian Association of Professionals with Disabilities works to bring down the barriers preventing people with disabilities from participating in the workforce. And CACTUS, that's the Canadian Association of Community Television Users and Stations, says that Canada's telecommunications regulator must ensure that media production is accessible to the public, and they are calling for support from the community radio sector. All that is coming up, but first, headlines.
Canadian Youth Delegation to Copenhagen has been reporting daily from the international climate negotiations in their report from the final day of negotiations, on which Canada was awarded the Fossil Fuel Award of the Year by various NGOs. Ria Trivedi gives a rundown on leaders' attempts to churn out some form of agreement.
The likelihood right now is a greenwash, is either a political statement or a decision from the COP that basically doesn't say very much, that doesn't have any specific targets or any overarching target for the global carbon budget, that doesn't have any schedule for adaptation financing, that doesn't commit developed countries to legally binding technological or financial transfers to the global south, things, it doesn't really matter anymore. What matters is that everyone is holding their leaders accountable so that they can't compromise the planet and they can't compromise the survival of developing nations. It just matters that we scream until they listen.
With more environmental news, here's CKUT's Fabian Ebeling.
On Sunday, December 13th, 1,200 residents of Sept-Îles, Quebec, marched against uranium exploration taking place just outside of the town and less than 13 kilometers from the local drinking water source. The protest was also in support for 24 doctors who resign en masse to protest provincial government inaction on the issue.
On December 15th, CKUT's Jezera Sinclair spoke to Marc Fafard, spokesperson for the citizen-based coalition Sept-Îles sans uranium.
And we're trying to make this a provincial debate. For us, all of Quebec should be asked the question, every citizen, do we want Quebec to become a uranium-producing province, and do we want, and are we aware that we're going to have to manage those wastes forever?
And that report was produced in collaboration with the Dominion, dominionpaper.ca. And in the days following that interview, the Terra Ventures company announced that it would suspend its uranium drilling in the Sept-Îles region. The Quebec minister responsible for mining has also indicated that the province of Quebec will not renew the company's drilling license, according to the Quebec City newspaper Le Soleil. On December 18th, a rally took place in downtown Montreal, protesting the exclusion of domestic workers from the Quebec law on accident and professional illness. In Quebec, all workers have access to compensation for work-related injuries, except for professional athletes and domestic workers. The protest on December 18th marked International Migrants Day. A great number of domestic workers are migrant women from the Philippines who come to Canada through the Living Caregiver Program, also known as the LCP. Nearly 100,000 Filipino women have come to Canada through the LCP since the 1980s. Evelyn Kalugay is the chairperson of PINAI, the Filipino Women's Organization of Quebec.
When they get injured or they get sick from the illness of a contagious disease or from somebody who they are taking care of, and they cannot go to work, let's say for a month or so, if they break a bone or something, they don't get any income.
She added that the threat of deportation discourages many domestic workers from complaining about unsafe working conditions. The Philippine Women's Center of BC, which is part of the National Alliance of Philippine Women in Canada, released a statement this month criticizing proposed changes to the LCP. Glessie Duran, a former living caregiver and the chair of SICLAB, the Filipino Migrant Workers Organization of British Columbia, said in the statement that, quote, "The live-in requirement is one of the fundamental discriminatory aspects of the LCP. Refusing to remove this requirement leaves living caregivers vulnerable to abuse," end quote.
Following two hunger strikes, Mohamed Majoub remains the sole prisoner in the Kingston Immigration Holding Center. CKUT's Fabian Ebeling has more.
On November the 30th, the federal court ordered that Mohammad Majoub should be released from the Kingston Immigration Holding Center, KIHC, into house arrest. But Majoub will not be removed to his apartment until bail money is raised and other court-imposed conditions put in place. Until then, Mr. Majoub remains alone at the KIHC, a situation that has already led him to a six-month life-threatening hunger strike. He was first released into house arrest in 2007 but requested to return to the holding center in March of this year because, according to People's Commission website, he could no longer subject his family to the intolerable and humiliating invasions of their privacy that the conditions of his house arrest required.
Thesis, for example, was listening to my conversation with my lawyer all the time when I was under house arrest. They prevented me to go to mosque to practice my religion when I was under house arrest.
Mohammed Seki Majoub came to Canada in 1995 to flee from political persecution and torture he suffered in Egypt. The now 50-year-old father of two sons was accepted under refugee status in 1996. 4 years later, he was arrested on a security certificate, a piece of legislation that allows Canada to detain foreign-born individuals on secret evidence without charge and to expel them if they are considered a risk to so-called national security. The interview with Mr. Majoub was conducted by Kavita Bisondial. For more information, please visit www.peoplescommission.org.
The Ontario government has recently paid over $5 million to Platinex Incorporated, a platinum exploration company. This payout is in response to the ongoing dispute between Platinex and the KI First Nation, which has asserted decision-making power over its traditional territory. Platinex has been attempting to perform mineral exploration there on and off for many years. But members of the KI First Nation have blocked Platinex from entering the site on two occasions. The first ended on March 17, 2008, with several months jail time for KI's chief and counsel. The Platinex deal with the Ontario government to surrender its claims and leases results from the second blockade. This took place in August 2009, when Chief Donnie Morris prevented Platinex's float plane from landing. The KI First Nation leadership has described the deal between Ontario and Platinex as a major success, and they are planning to meet with the Ontario government to craft a memorandum of cooperation. KI Chief Donnie Morrison was quoted in a press release sent out on December 14th saying, quote, "The memorandum of cooperation will become a model for how future problems like this will not happen again." He goes on to say, "I think the province needs to recognize that our free prior informed consent is necessary, or mining development in the north could become a very expensive failure," end quote. We'll be back with more news after this break. Please remember that Grand Wire is listener supported. You can donate to Grand Wire at ncra.ca.
Groundwire is a national grassroots news program. To sponsor an edition, email groundwirepitch@ncra.ca. For their support, Groundwire thanks the Public Service Alliance of Canada, performing quality public service on behalf of Canadians. To learn more, visit www.psac.com.
If you're gonna hit me with a white belt, if you're gonna hit me with a white belt, if you're gonna hit me with a white belt, you better pray I don't get up. You see, I'm stronger than you think, and I've been clean, clean. Now you've made me angry, so I'm gonna show you mean. If you're gonna hit me with a white belt, if you're gonna hit me with a white belt, if you're gonna hit me with a white belt, you better pray I don't.
Sherry Morocco singing White Belts here on Groundwire.
Now it's time for the Community Radio Report. Only this week, Groundwire reaches out to report on our brothers and sisters in community television. Following closely on the heels of the CRTC's hearings on community radio, the CRTC Community Television Review will highlight many of the same issues that community radio has faced in the past. The Canadian Association of Community Television Users and Stations, CACTUS, is trying to get the word out. Jackie Tunstra Harrison has more.
Community radio supporters just finished commenting on the upcoming Canadian Radio Telecommunications Commission hearings on our sector. But in a new round of CRTC consultations on community television, radio broadcasters may have found a new partner and an innovative way to keep our sector alive. Catherine Edwards of CACTUS, the Canadian Association of Community Television Users and Stations, explains that the decline of community television is a tragic tale for Canadian independent media.
The history of community TV in Canada has been tied to the development of the cable industry. It evolved in the late 60s from some experiments at the National Film Board called Challenge for Change, where NFB filmmakers are being sent to communities in trouble to find out what community members thought of an issue and report back to government. And they found really quickly that the community wanted to be in control of the media, wanted to be able to edit what they were saying, look at these tapes together, and they found that in that process they often came up with solutions to their own problems. And cable happened to be coming into Canada, and they decided to make it a license requirement of cable companies to offer one channel for the public to use to make its own messages. Community television channels opened Canada-wide, almost with one pen stroke.
Once there were 300 community stations, now only a third of the original stations have true community access. That means fewer than 10% of Canadians can participate on their own airwaves. From coast to coast, stations are tuning out of their communities. 12 offices in Vancouver became one, and in New Brunswick, 30 stations have become a mere six.
We estimate that only about 10% of Canadians can actually get on a so-called community channel anymore. Community radio had been in the nice position of being under community control. It was always recognized as a separate sector, but there was no strong funding formula for community radio, so it was kind of the opposite situation. We have to find a funding formula for radio, and we have to find a better distribution. Formula for community TV, which is under community control.
With community television and community radio mirroring the same broadcasting values of public participation and facing similar funding challenges, Edwards holds out an opportunity for community radio supporters to work together with community television advocates in these upcoming CRTC hearings.
A lot of people feel that television as a medium is gradually on its way out. We're asking that the money that cable companies currently spend are supposed to be spending on community access be liberated to an independent production fund that communities could apply to, but we don't see the money being used specifically for television channels. We see them as multi-platform production access centers, under the roof with a film or a video co-op or an existing community radio station, so that people can go to one place for their communication needs. And we see that there might be training and equipment offered, possibly in radio, in video, in, helping people develop their own websites, new media. The NCRA, I know, did make a comment in its submission in support of our vision and wanting to explore that. It says we're trying to position them as a basic public resource like a library. So historically and traditionally, whereas a library is where you go to inform yourself about something, we feel that in such a complicated media environment all the time, and it's not going to get easier, I think there's going to always be new technologies coming online that ordinary people need to know about to participate fully in society, that we need to go further than public libraries. We need to also enable people to produce media, give them the tools to do it, and make sure that they can be heard once they've done it. So we just feel that by recognizing that people use lots of media and trying to make that available at one place for people, we can increase the traffic for all our services and attract more funding support, frankly.
The deadline for comments to the CRTC is February 1st. To find out more about CACTUS's multi-platform proposal for community broadcasting, visit openmedia.ca or cactusindependentmedia.ca. For Groundwire, this is Jackie Townster-Harrison reporting.
And now for our features.
First up, 12 months after the Gaza War, CKUT's Aaron Lakoff reviews the progress of movements opposing the occupation of Gaza by the Israeli military. Stay tuned.
It's been nearly 1 year since Israel launched its three-week-long attack on the occupied Gaza Strip, which it dubbed Operation Cast Lead. In the aftermath, over 1,300 Palestinians were killed, the vast majority of them civilians, while on the other side, there were 13 Israeli casualties. GroundWire sat down with Nina Amrov of Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights in Montreal. Amrov is a Palestinian Canadian who helped organize many of the large demonstrations against the war on Gaza. Here is some of that conversation. Welcome to GroundWire, Nina.
Thank you, Aaron.
So we're going to be talking about a reflection on the one-year anniversary since the Gaza massacre, which of course started December 27th, 2008. Now that we're almost 1 year away from the outbreak of that war, what are some of your general reflections both on the war and some of the things that we learned in the aftermath?
In regards to the attacks on Gaza, of course, the fact that it was denounced as a war crime on an international level and was articulated by the international institution in a very explicit manner, that is something to consider. For the past year, another thing has been highlighted here at home in Canada is the unwillingness of our government, Canadian government, to explicitly denounce Israeli war crimes.
Now, one interesting thing about these demonstrations that was a pretty new thing that we haven't necessarily seen with large demonstrations for Palestine in the past is that there is a very clear call for the BDS campaign, boycott, divestments, and sanctions, coming out of these demonstrations. How would you say this is translated or been carried forth in the aftermath of this war?
Well, I think first off, what was amazing about those demos is that we saw a grouping of people from different organizations, from different levels of society. We had worker unions, we had student unions, not even because we always tend to think that it's always the Arab organizations and the Muslim associations that always only support the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian struggle. It was very diverse and very vibrant as a groupment of people who were all there to support. There to advocate the word for human rights, for Palestinian human rights. Coming to the BDS call, what's special about the BDS call is the fact that for the first time ever, the people who are calling for BDS is Palestinian civil society. So we're talking about political parties, unions, students, professors, you name it. They're the ones who made this call to the international civil society to engage in a boycott, sanction, and divestment campaign in order to pressure Israel to comply by international law.
Looking at either the international level or the Canadian level, mm-hmm. How much progress would you say we've made over the last year in terms of bringing justice to such a grave situation? And maybe you could talk a little bit about some of the victories that we've seen, again, either in Canada or internationally.
Sure. Of course, here in Quebec, there have been, and in Canada as well, there have been a lot of successes. We had several worker unions who have passed a BDS legislation. We're talking about the CSQ. We're talking about La FNEC, which is the Federation of Teachers here in Quebec. We also, a political party on the provincial level, Quebec Solidaire, also passed a legislation for BDS. So these are amazing successes because we're seeing that it's reaching organizations, and they're reaching organizations who have a huge influence on their workers or on their members.
We've been speaking with Nina Amrov from Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights in Montreal. Thank you so much, Nina.
Thank you.
This feature was produced for GroundWire by CKUT's Aaron Lakoff.
More news to come on GroundWire right after this musical break. Edition of the Artists Against Apartheid concert series at the Sala Rosa in Montreal. Up next on GroundWire, violence against sex workers is an ever-present problem in Montreal and around the world. A march was held by Stella, a local sex workers advocacy group, on December 17th at Papineau Station in downtown Montreal to mark the 7th annual International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers. For more on this, here's CKUT's Dee LeCompte with Fabienne Ebeling.
On December 17th, Sex workers and their allies took to the streets in downtown Montreal to protest violence against sex workers. The 7th International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers also marked the occasion to protest against the criminalization of sex work. Each day, many sex workers face hatred, discrimination, and police repression. The criminalization of sex work-related activities leads to physical and sexual violence against sex workers. CKUT was on location to talk to Anna Louise Crago, representative of Stella. Stella is an organization by and for sex workers. The organization provides services to sex workers and does outreach work in several areas related to sex work. According to Statistics Canada, there have been 60 murders of sex workers in the last 4 years. More than 60 attacks in Montreal are reported to Stella each year.
Since this past August, there's been an extremely terrifying rise in acts of extreme violence against sex workers that's happened at around the same time as there's been massive police repression against sex trade workers on the street in downtown Montreal and in Hochelaga-Maisonneuve. Aboriginal sex workers have been disproportionately targeted by that violence. I think one of the hidden sides of violence that isn't talked about much is the psychological violence of stigma and discrimination and of scapegoating. And sex workers on the street in many neighborhoods in Montreal are scapegoated for all variety of social problems, are pointed out, and often face violence as a result of it. We would like to see, because a lot of the women in the neighborhood are facing extremely high levels of violence, the opening of safe places where if sex workers want to, only if they want to, they could bring their clients and work safely and be protected from violence. We wish that sex workers in the most precarious situations facing the most human rights abuses would have that option. Unfortunately, due to the hypocrisy of the laws at this point in Canada, although the selling of sexual services is not illegal, it is highly criminalized, and the result of that hypocrisy is that women are paying for it with their lives.
The particularly high rate of violence committed against Aboriginal sex workers must not be ignored. We also talked to Jessica Yee, who is the founder and executive director of the Native Youth Sexual Health Network.
It is to realize that because of our race and because of the ignorance around sex work that it increases our vulnerability to violence. So yes, for example, Aboriginal women are 5 times more likely to die of violence than non-Aboriginal women, but it kind of starts with the fact that our women have been perishing for thousands of years, and it's so due to ignorance and shame and stigma and discrimination and things like that. And so the biggest problem lies in our stigma and shame, and then it's connected to our heightened vulnerability to violence, our unwillingness to come to terms with talking about sex, which is definitely related to the ostracism that sex workers face, because you can't even talk about sex. How can you talk about that as a form of trade or work? And I would also say that, you know, Indigenous sex workers are often on the lower end spectrum of paid sex work because they go with what they know. So we'll find more Aboriginal sex workers who are street based. There's a lot of classism even within sex work, right? That people don't really realize if they don't take the time to understand the nature of the work. It frustrates me when I know that, you know, we have these issues to address, but we can't even get our foot in the door because we're not even willing to talk about it. Stigma and shame and discrimination kills women.
And that was Jessica Yee, founder and executive director of the Native Youth Sexual Health Network. You can find more about their work at nativeyouthsexualhealth.com. Thanks to Fabian Ebeling and Dee LeCompte for that report. Up next, VoicePrint is a volunteer-based broadcasting service that provides readings of articles from newspapers and magazines for Canadians who can't access printed materials due to barriers, including low literacy skills. VoicePrint's Michael Slack sat down recently with Marco Bach, who is president of the nonprofit Canadian Association of Professionals with Disabilities, to talk about the obstacles to and the economic benefits of disabled people's involvement in the workforce.
Ms. Bog, the first thing that struck me about it is the Canadian Association of Professionals with Disabilities. It's professionals first, and then disability second, if you will, as opposed to saying disabled professionals. So you've got a number of like-minded people who started this organization to change the perceptions really out there. How do you go about changing people's perceptions?
Changing people's perceptions, it's a long, drawn-out effort. It is basically through education, through legislation, through bringing the issues to the forefront on what's really affecting professionals with disabilities. We are finding that the professionals with disabilities are getting more into the vocabulary of the business and in employment equity than it was when before we started, which is good that they're thinking about us. But it's really giving credence that we are out there, our talents are being underutilized or not being utilized at all. And I think we have to be sitting at the table of the decision makers, not being an adjunct to some type of program or an afterthought. I think for a lot of people with disabilities in regards to employment equity issues, that sometimes we're the forgotten group in regards to employment issues. And we have to be there at the table, and people have to take us seriously. And I think that if we get more professionals with disabilities coming together to be a united voice with all these capabilities, we can, you know, speak up for other professionals with disabilities, but also for people with disabilities in general in regards to employment issues.
Absolutely, and that's important, as you're saying, to sit at the table. The perception, I mean, you're saying it does take a long time. It does take a long time to change because we have to go to the root of it. And once society sees that disabled people aren't to be taken care of like they were in the past, but instead need to be embraced as viable members of society because not only do they have something to contribute, but it just makes economic sense.
It does. It does make economic sense, and people just have to change their mindset in regards to that. And it's like you said, we have to get to the root cause, and there's many root causes in regards to perceptions and why people behave the way they do in regards to when they meet or work with a person with a disability.
Could you outline for me some of the more notable excuses for not hiring a professional with a disability?
One excuse is I hired one person with a disability, it didn't work out. That's an excuse. Another excuse is that they don't have enough energy to do a certain job. Another one is that they get sick. Another one is that they're not smart enough.
Well, these are very, very simplified excuses, aren't they?
I know they are.
Economists and even the federal government have acknowledged that a labor shortage exists in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
What role do you think professionals with disabilities could take in reducing that shortage?
Well, we have to be in their face, basically. Now, for a lot of professionals with disabilities, I've heard about the employment shortage 10 years ago when I got my MBA, and I was told to wait until all the baby boomers retired. And so, you know, we waited, and I think it was just an excuse. For people with disabilities, they're often the last one to be thought of in terms of filling a gap in terms of a shortage in labor. They'll go to other groups before they will, look at us.
Thanks to VoicePrint's Paul Daniel and Michael Slack for that interview with Marco Bach, president of the Canadian Association for Professionals with Disabilities.
That does it for this edition of Groundwire, a bi-weekly nonprofit national news program produced by our communities for our communities. Groundwire is heard on dozens of campus and community radio stations across the country.
All episodes of Groundwire are available for listening or podcasting at groundwire.ncra.ca. If you're interested in contributing as a journalist or producing an episode, get in touch with us by email at groundwire@ncra.ca. That's groundwire@ncra.ca. This month's edition was produced at CKUT in Montreal. My name is David Koch. I've been your host with Courtney Kirkby.